You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 lectures translated by Matthew Barton, entitled The Human Being as Spiritual Being, Evolving Through the Course of History. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on the 5th of August, 1921. In recent reflections, I have presented various things in order to help us understand our contemporary culture and its evolutionary potential. In the course of these lectures, I expressed the need to consider antecedents in humanity's evolution that have, subsequently, led us to the condition of soul in which this modern culture is now unfolding. Let us once again consider the characteristics of this modern culture of ours. From all kinds of perspectives, we have formed the conviction, haven't we, that the basic tenor of this cultural life is intellectualism, an intellectual, rational engagement with the world and with human existence itself. This is not at odds with the fact that the outlook of our modern era lies essentially in seeking to observe outer sensory phenomena, and in the processing and assimilation of these phenomena. It is especially this that we will focus on in the coming days. Intellectualism itself first arose in the course of human evolution, around 300 years before the mystery of Golgotha, gradually developing to a culmination that it did not really surpass in the 300 years following the mystery of Golgotha. In the course of 600 years, therefore, we can say humanity was schooled in this intellectualism. Humanity developed beyond a spiritual worldview, one that in these 600 years gradually ebbed away. It is scarcely possible, as I noted previously, to study the ebbing tide of this worldview through external documents, since as Christianity later spread, its proponents took it upon themselves to destroy the great majority of earlier Gnostic scripts. As humanity's worldviews evolved, these Gnostic scripts had, on the one hand, absorbed something from more ancient traditions, from all that still existed of ancient wisdom in Asia, Africa, and Southern Europe, and from what human beings in later times, who could no longer see very far into higher supersensible realms, could still perceive. The more ancient wisdom, whose last echoes can still be found in pre-Socratic Greek philosophy, and still gleam through a little in Plato's works, did not work with intellectualism. Its content was largely won through supersensible perception, albeit also of an instinctive kind. This supersensible perception, at the same time, brings with it what we can call an inner systematized logicality. There is no need for intellectual analysis if one carries within one the content of supersensible vision, since its logical structure is intrinsically and naturally given. But the ability to reach to the level of this supersensible content was gradually lost to humanity, its last phase being preserved in Gnosticism. Actually, Gnosticism is itself pervaded by intellectualism already. And so we can say that in terms of human evolution, intellectualism was in a sense born from Gnosticism. It was born from supersensible, spiritual content, which gradually dried up to leave only intellectualism behind. Aristotle set the tone for this, working now entirely with intellectualism. We can already see with him, and this is not yet the case with Plato, how ancient spirituality has ended, and how the human being now seeks to arrive at a worldview founded on intellectual inner work. Aristotle is, in a sense, the first true intellectual in human evolution. Everywhere in his writings we encounter statements that show that a memory of ancient insights, won through supersensible perception, was still alive at the time in old traditions, but that Aristotle is no longer able to make what he cites of this kind an inner experienced reality for himself. Something that had once been intense experience becomes for him, to a great degree, mere words. By contrast, he now works intellectually in the most eminent sense. Due to the distinctive configuration of Greek culture, Aristotle is not a Gnostic. But in the Gnosticism that was still widespread at the time and continued on through the centuries after Christ, we find an intellectual apprehension of ancient spiritual tradition, though no longer any lived experience of it. In a sense, we find a shadow of ancient spiritual wisdom in what is embodied in the Gnostics. And basically, we can see how humanity slowly lost the ability to make sense of what had once been self-evident spiritual truths. The point at which no sense could any longer be made at all of ancient spiritual ideas arrived in the 4th century after Christ. In a figure such as Augustine, we can see most vividly how, out of the depths of his human soul, he wrestles for a worldview that it is now impossible for him to find through any kind of spiritual perception, and how instead he therefore eventually comes to accept and subscribe to the dogmas of the Catholic Church. The content of this Western culture, of which we shall be speaking initially, developed especially in the centuries following the first 4 centuries after the mystery of Golgotha. And this content came about by way of evolving Christian traditions that were gradually established in dogmas, that is, in intellectual thought forms, albeit related to a content that had once been a reality experienced in supersensible vision. Now, it was present only as a memory. It was no longer possible for people to see how their human existence was connected with these supersensible contents. That is, there was no longer any way to instruct people in the meaning of this supersensible content. And so, in the following centuries, up to the 15th century, the education of humanity tended largely in an intellectual direction. If you study the life of culture from the 4th and 5th centuries A.D. through to the 15th century, with everything that developed initially under the early ecclesiastical teachers and on to Scotus Origina, then through to Thomas Aquinas and Albertus Magnus, with all that people underwent during this period, the content of such teachings themselves is likely to strike you as less interesting than the highly significant manner of instruction and education that inculcated an intellectual mode of soul in people. The Christian philosophers of this time developed intellectuality, the assimilation of concepts, to the highest level. And while one can say, on the one hand, that the birth of intellectualism was accomplished during the 4th century A.D., nevertheless, as technique of thinking, intellectualism continued to be developed and elaborated through into the 15th century. Back in the 4th century, it had become possible for humankind to take hold of the intellectual element in the first place, but then it needed to be inwardly assimilated and penetrated. And what was accomplished in this way by the time of high scholasticism is indeed remarkable. Modern thinkers could actually learn a great deal if they would once again look to the scholastics of the Catholic Church in terms of the concept-forming abilities they developed, their conceptual techniques. When one thinks of the wretched kind of thinking that is now so common in modern science, when one thinks how the inner content of certain concepts, such as the concept of subsistence as opposed to existence, has been lost altogether, concepts without which you can't even develop a worldview, or when one thinks how terms such as hypothesis have assumed a completely muddled character, whereas in the time of the scholastics it presented a rigorously defined figure of thought. Then, along with much else of the kind one might cite, one sees how mainstream culture today no longer shows any mastery of the technique of thinking, and how much could be learned if people were to acquaint themselves once more with the highly schooled thinking that was developed up to the 15th century. The reason thinkers schooled in this way are so far ahead of modern philosophers is simply that such thinkers have absorbed the element of scholasticism. It brings something like relief when, turning aside from the wretched thinking of modern scientific literature, one takes up a book such as titled The History of Idealism by Willmann. Its content, of course, is not something we would agree with nowadays, but would vigorously oppose. Nevertheless, it displays a form of active thinking that brings relief and reassurance by comparison to the kind of modern thinking I described. This title, History of Idealism, by Otto Willmann, should be read even by those who see things from a very different perspective. The way this author expounds the problems of philosophy since Plato, and does so with full command of scholastic thinking, will at least offer modern minds the model of highly disciplined thought. Thus, these techniques of thinking were largely developed between the 4th century and the 15th century. And such thinking initially culminated in a very specific engagement of the human capacity for inquiry with world content. We can put it like this. Minds such as Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas placed thinking activity, as it had so far developed, in an impeccable relationship with world content. How do we perceive this in them? These thinkers had initially received such content from ancient traditions, whose meaning was no longer understood, had received it as dogma. Their first task was to defend and protect this as the content of a revelation superordinate to nature, as, and at the time this meant roughly the same, a supersensible revelation. The Church preserved this revelation by its position of authority. Whatever could be said about supersensible worlds was believed to be contained in the dogmas of the Church. And whatever was there contained was simply to be accepted as a revelation that lay beyond the reach of human reason, of human intellectuality. Thus, in this medieval era, it was a self-evident thing to employ what had been developed to a high degree as intellectual technique. And yet, on the other hand, it was clear that this intellectuality was not permitted to make inroads into the contents of dogmas. The loftiest truths needed by humankind were sought in these dogmas, which were drawn from supernatural theology, and contained, more or less, everything relating to the higher destinies of human soul life. On the other hand, these views were imbued with the sense that the intellectuality human beings had developed could be used to understand and explain the natural world, that through rationality, thus intellectuality, it was also possible to arrive at a certain abstract understanding of the beginning and end of the world, and also the being of God, and so forth. Such things, albeit in a certain abstract form, were counted among those that human beings could attain to through the techniques of intellectual thought. In other words, human knowledge was split into two main realms, of the supersensible that could only reach humankind through revelation and was preserved in Christian dogma, and the realm of nature and scientific study of nature, insofar as this existed then, whose whole scope was available to the techniques of intellectual inquiry. This duality in medieval knowledge must be fully understood if we wish to grasp modern developments in thinking and culture. From the 15th century, at first more slowly, and then with increasing rapidity, areas of knowledge developed that came to form the content of the modern scientific outlook. Up to the 15th century, the intellect itself had developed its techniques, but during this era possessed a knowledge of nature which up to this time largely came from traditional sources, from things little understood anymore. We can say that the intellect had not as yet tested itself through inquiry into direct and primary contents. This only happened when the deeds of Copernicus, Galileo, and others found their consequences in modern scientific developments. A time arrived when the intellect no longer merely developed its techniques, but when this intellect began to engage with the external world. We can especially see how a mind such as Galileo first draws on the hitherto developed techniques of thinking to tackle outer, sense-perceptible contents. Over the next centuries, through to the 19th, the quest for knowledge involved an engagement of the intellect in natural inquiry, the study of the natural world. But what lives on in this engagement of the intellect with natural science? Here we must relinquish all preconceived ideas and proceed according to psychological and historical realities. We have to fully recognize that humankind does not simply carry the theories of a past age on into a new era, but that developments in Christian philosophy had established the very powerful impulse to apply the intellect only to the sensory world, and to avoid all super-sensible inquiry. It would formerly have been sinful, you see, for someone seeking knowledge to use the intellect to delve into the super-sensible realm. This leads to a certain habit of thought, and such habits are perpetuated. People do not become fully aware of them, and yet their actions are influenced by such habits. This habit of thought, one engendered by the influence of Christian dogma, gave rise, in centuries preceding the 19th, to the urge to use the intellect only in relation to external sense observations. Just as the universities in general perpetuated schools of thought established by the church, so science practiced at these universities was very much a continuation of what the church had accepted as correct in the field of natural inquiry. Efforts to include in such inquiry nothing but empirical data drawn from the external world of the senses is very much the echoing reverberation of a habit of soul arising from Christian dogma. Parallel with this application of the intellect to the outer sense world, the soul's preoccupation with the contents of supersensible dogma increasingly paled into insignificance. It had become possible to study and research by one's own powers, to gain one's own content of intellectual knowledge, albeit only with the sensory content. Under the influence of what one might call the ever more positive contents of knowledge about the sense world, dogmatic knowledge paled. It was soon no longer possible for the human soul to gain a relationship with this supersensible content, which, after the 4th century A.D., had remained as a memory of something humanity had once experienced in very ancient times. All that related to supersensible worlds gradually faded away entirely, and what remained of it in cultural developments over the past 3 or 4 centuries was merely an artificial perpetuation of this supersensible content. Instead, the content drawn from the world of the senses and processed by the intellect becomes ever more copious and abundant. The human soul imbues itself with these contents, while attention to supersensible contents increasingly fades. And this is very much an outcome of the developments in Christian dogma. Then came the 19th century, when the human soul's direct relationship with supersensible content had faded altogether, so that it grew ever more necessary to persuade oneself in what I will call an artificial way, that it was still important to assume the existence of a supersensible world. Especially in the 19th century, though this was well prepared beforehand, a doctrine emerged of two possible paths of inquiry, the path of knowledge and that of faith. A faith entirely founded on merely subjective conviction was meant to shore up what had remained of the old traditions and dogmas. At the same time, people were increasingly overwhelmed, one might say, by results of scientific inquiry into the world of the senses. By the mid-19th century, European culture had reached a point where superfluity of sense knowledge contrasted with a problematic relationship to the supersensible world. In studying the sense world, people felt they were always on solid ground, were able to point to facts arising from outward observation, and could combine all these facts into a kind of picture of the world that, it is true, contained only sensory data, but was growing ever more complete. By contrast, maintaining faith in the supersensible realm became something of a desperate effort. Especially noteworthy in this respect in the development of theology, especially Christology, in the 19th century. Here we see how any supersensible content in the concept of Christ is gradually lost, eventually leaving nothing more than Jesus of Nazareth, as a figure present in the world of the senses, as someone, therefore, who could be seen only as a member of humanity in the ordinary sensory meaning, and in the life of the senses available to the intellect. Efforts were made to preserve Christianity, even in the face of modern enlightenment and science, by subjecting it to a critique that dissolved it, by sieving carefully through the content of the Gospels in the quest to define what might at least justify tenets of faith in a supersensible world. This evolution took a noteworthy form in the middle of the 19th century especially, a developmental phase that should not be overlooked by anyone who concerns themselves with modern spiritual science. Those who have in recent times spoken a great deal about spirit and culture dismiss in simplistic terms as materialism what arose in human evolution in the mid-19th century. It is certainly superficial to pay heed only to this materialism, but even more superficial is to adopt a trivializing stance toward it. It is relatively easy to acquire various concepts of spirit and culture and then to simply dismiss what arose in 19th century materialism. In fact, we have to consider the matter from another perspective. The truth is that someone such as Heinrich Zolbe, for example, perhaps one of the most outstanding thinkers of this kind, defined in his 1855 book titled A New Account of Sensualism, a quest for knowledge that intrinsically excludes the supersensible. In this system of Zolbe's, therefore, we have something that seeks to explain the world and also the human being purely through what is available to sensory observation. This system of sensualism is superficial, certainly, on the one hand, but on the other also extraordinarily acute. He attempts to make sensory perception the foundation from which everything else can be deduced, right through to politics, to present all human phenomena as if they could be explained through what the senses can observe, and what the intellect can formulate by means of combining these sense observations. This book was published in 1855, thus at a time when Darwinism had not yet fully emerged, since Darwin's innovative work was not published until 1859. As I have often remarked, this year, 1859, was altogether an incisive one in modern spiritual evolution. Darwin's book, titled On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, appeared then, and around the same time spectral analysis emerges, giving rise to the view that the whole universe consists of the same material substances from which the earth is formed. Then, also, we see attempts to comprehend the aesthetic realm, something previously always approached spiritually and intellectually through external sensory empiricism. Gustav Theodor Fechner's title Foundations of Aesthetics appeared in 1876. And finally, we see the attempt to apply the mode of thinking implicit in all I have here cited to the life of society. Karl Marx's first great work on economics likewise appeared in 1859. This fourth phenomenon of modern materialistic culture thus appears at exactly the same time, though, as I have said, it was preceded by such works as those of Zolba on sense-based knowledge. In respect, therefore, of everything since then discovered as facts of outward sense life, and the efforts made to apply materialistic outlooks to these discoveries, we can say that this materialistic outlook was not created by Darwinism, say, or by spectral analysis. Rather, what Darwin so painstakingly compiled, and what could be derived to a certain extent from spectral analysis, all that could be deduced from things themselves, as in Fechner's title Foundations of Aesthetics, that previously had been investigated, only in quite other ways, was imbued with this same outlook drawn from sensualism, from sense-based knowledge. And materialism was basically already present, already anticipated these developments, but was an offspring of that custom of thinking which emerged from scholastic thought. We fail to understand the development of modern thought and materialism itself if we do not recognize it to be an offspring of medieval thought, though one that dispensed with the need to ascend from thinking to the supersensible, an ascent no longer calling on human reason and human observation, but only on revelations given in ecclesiastical dogma. This second aspect was simply relinquished, while retaining the basic conviction concerning the one side of knowledge, which related to the world of the senses. And during the 19th century, what had in this way developed appeared, for instance, in Dubois Reymond's famous Ignorabimus at the beginning of the 1870s. The scholastics said that human knowledge, imbued by the intellect, related only to the external sense world. Everything that humankind should perceive about the supersensible realm must, on the other hand, be furnished by the revelation preserved in dogmas. This revelation preserved in church dogma faded out of the picture, leaving only the other fundamental conviction, and is then given clearly defined expression by Dubois Reymond, albeit in modern clothing. And what had resounded in scholasticism in the way I have just described, he now restates as the human ability only to discern sensory things, the requirement only to investigate the sensory realm, since there is no such thing as a knowledge of the supersensible. Basically, there is no difference between scholasticism's one field of knowledge and what has emerged, albeit in modern garments, in modern scientists. And Dubois Reymond was one of the most modern. It is extremely important to take a serious look at how this modern outlook arose from scholasticism, since people always think it has developed in opposition to scholasticism. In fact, just as little as modern universities can deny that their structures originated in scholasticism, so likewise, the structure of modern scientific thinking undeniably arose from scholasticism, from which it has merely cast off one aspect, as I said before, arising from the latter's highly praiseworthy elaboration of concepts and thinking techniques. This thinking technique has also been lost. And this is why modern scientific appraisals elegantly overlook or circumvent certain things in a way that is unsatisfactory for real thinkers. Nevertheless, the spirit, the intention alive in this modern science, is an offspring of scholasticism. So it had become customary to limit oneself to investigating the sense world. But this approach has also brought about something that is certainly good. It gave rise to the inclination to study realities of the sense world in thorough detail. We need only consider that for modern spiritual science, for anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, the sense world is an image, a reflection of the supersensible world. That what we discern in the sense world really does contain images of the supersensible realm. With this in mind, we can greatly value the scope of human investigation of the sensory material world. By contrast, we must repeatedly state that the other form of materialism that has emerged as spiritualism, which seeks to perceive the spirit in material terms, is unfruitful, since the spirit can, of course, never be available to sense perception. Its whole methodology is therefore vacuous. We have to acknowledge that what people observe with their ordinary senses and what the intellect, developed through human evolution, derives from sense observation and organizes and combines is certainly a reflection of the supersensible world, and that a study of this reflection, in some respects, leads us far more surely into the supersensible world than spiritualism does. On previous occasions, I often put this as follows. A circle of people sit around a table and speak of spirits, but completely overlook the fact that a whole number of spirits are already sitting round the table. They ought to become aware of their own spirit, for this definitely represents what it is they seek. But in forgetting this spirit of their own, in failing to comprehend this spirit of their own, they end up seeking the spirit in an outward and material way through all kinds of spiritualist experiments, merely imitated from laboratory experiments. Thus materialism works with reflected images of the supersensible realm without knowing that it is doing so. And in relation to its methods of research, this materialism has achieved great and magnificent things. Certainly true materialists, sense-based investigators, and we see this very clearly in Zolba, have never sought to relate sensory phenomena to any kind of supersensible reality. But they have sought to study and know the sense realm as such, in its structure and lawfulness. If we compare what exists in the first half of the 19th century, in terms of a synopsis of sense realities, we have to say this is piecemeal compared to the work that was accomplished from the 1840s onward. And when Darwinism then arose with its great survey and perspective, when Darwin himself showed how a wealth of facts could be surveyed and combined under certain perspectives, then it became apparent that this could offer, to start with, a principle of investigation, a methodology of study. There were conscientious scientists in the 19th century, such as Gegenbauer, who never came over to Darwinism entirely as Haeckel did. But what Gegenbauer, who also continued Goethe's work on the transformation of the vertebra, the bones of the skull, especially emphasized was that whatever the truth, the absolute truth or otherwise of Darwinism, nevertheless, Darwin had initiated a methodology enabling scientists to connect and compare phenomena in a way that allowed them to note and observe things they could not otherwise have done without this method. Gegenbauer put it roughly like this. Even if all Darwinistic theory were to disappear, nevertheless it has given rise to a particular mode of research, allowing facts to be discovered that could not have been found without it. It involved a certain practical application of the, in quotes, as-if principle, an application of it that is not as foolish as the philosophical concretization of this principle which later emerged. And thus it came about that in the second half of the 19th century, cultural life took shape in a curious way. In recent times, which do not go so very far back, philosophy had basically always emerged from the theological element. Those who no longer see the theological element present in Hume and Kant will fail to understand this. Philosophy certainly arose from theology, in a sense elaborating and assimilating in intellectual concepts, things that shone with a halfway supersensible iridescence. And because philosophy possessed this intrinsically supersensible shimmer, science from the mid-19th century onward increasingly declared war on it. The inclination for supersensible content in human knowledge had faded away. Science had its own substance-based content in which trust was to be placed. And developments in philosophy stood by more or less impotently in the face of what streamed ever more copiously through science, though this also gave rise to philosophical problems, albeit ones sometimes regarded with a skeptical eye. It is indeed interesting that the most striking philosophy in the second half of the 19th century was compelled to point to the unconscious rather than the conscious mind. Thus the philosophy of Edward von Hartmann discarded the intellect in order to survive at all as philosophy. And as the 19th century drew to a close, we find the curious drama of philosophy becoming ever more devoid of content, increasingly seeking to justify its existence. The most acute philosophers, such as Otto Liebmann, are then primarily concerned with justifying the pursuit of philosophy in some way. But there is a good deal of affinity between a philosopher like Otto Liebmann, who is still trying to justify the place of philosophy, and another who wrote the book titled The Whole of Philosophy and Its End, Richard Wallah, who with great acuity sought to demonstrate that philosophy itself cannot exist. In reward for his services to a discipline that, according to his evidence, cannot even exist, he was given a professorship in philosophy at an Austrian university. In the 1890s, a remarkable developmental stage emerges as the outcome of modern thought and knowledge. On the one hand, we have in science endeavors to advance toward a comprehensive worldview, to dismiss everything of the nature of revelation and the supersensible, and on the other hand, a philosophy grown feeble. This became significantly apparent in the last decade of the 19th century, arising as an inevitable result of preceding developments. Tomorrow we will trace the course of these developments further. But what I would like you to fix in your minds is that modern materialism should be seen in these terms, that what we find before us in material existence is a reflection of supersensible realities. Human beings themselves, in their existence between birth and death, are a reflection of what each passes through supersensibly between their previous death and the latest birth. And whoever seeks the soul within matter is looking in the wrong place for it. The fundamental question that we must consider if we wish to understand the historical significance of 19th century materialism is this: to what degree was it justified? You see, merely contesting and disputing it does not allow us to understand its place in history. Instead, we need to recognize what it lacked, what it necessarily lacked because an era immediately preceding it had sought soul and spirit in the wrong place. People had believed that they could find the spirit and soul by seeking it in sensory existence in the ordinary way, by means of various deliberations and reflections. But this cannot be done. We can only find spirit and soul by going beyond the sense world. Sensualism and materialism did not wish to, and were unable to do so. They stopped short at the reflected image and saw it as reality. That is the real nature of materialism, which we will examine more closely tomorrow. The end of Lecture 4.